Well, hi, everybody. I hope you're doing great. Thanks again for the comments and the questions that you've sent in. I appreciate that, and I'm glad you're finding this valuable. Thanks for the kind words. Remember that we can go over at the top of the hour, at the end of this seminar, if there are things you'd like to discuss or questions you have, for us to discuss a bit more, for something that we might not have covered as fully as you'd like or that you still have questions about. First, any comments or questions before we launch into the material for the final seminar? We're going to be talking today about the challenges of extreme success and mostly the kinds of things that your clients may not have experience in engaging or ways of navigating for experiences that are categorically different than anything they've experienced before. And we'll talk about that in some depth. But anything you want to add or ask before we go on lecture mode? Then we'll move into that and jot down any questions or comments you have, and we'll have a discussion at the end. I want to talk about something that we, in my view, may not talk enough about in coaching, and that's exceptional achievement and overconfidence, the things especially that go beyond what someone has ever experienced before, that they have no internal models and thereby no intuition about how to respond. For example, if you ask any player in a physician's basketball league whether he or she would compete with LeBron James, they laugh. Yet many of those same physicians willingly compete with the billionaire investor Warren Buffett. cognitive biases and mental errors make them believe they can outperform successful full-time investment experts. I know about these things. I've played on those teams and in those leagues. Those who have achieved in exceptional ways can create challenges for themselves just because of the attainment of that success. Some very successful individuals, from expert actors and athletes to practicing medical and legal experts, begin to believe they can be good in other areas, such as investing. Expertise in one area does not equate with expertise in another. Even Warren Buffett recognized this about himself. He said, "I don't think being able to allocate capital means you're good at anything else." Overconfidence creates a misperception of ability when it's informed by particular success in one area. University of Pennsylvania psychologists Philip Tetlock and Barbara Mellers studied over 25,000 forecasts from people whose task it was to anticipate how the future would unfold in various areas. Their studies, like a number of others, revealed exceptional overconfidence in the judgments of doctors, lawyers, engineers, and even scientists in their decision-making processes. The stimulation of overconfidence, the mindset because of that excitement, can be biologically habituating. Look at recent revelations of politicians, actors, athletes who came to believe that their success made them immune to boundary violations. From Macbeth, we learned that we are most vulnerable not when we're beginning, not even when we're destitute or needy, but after the biggest triumphs of our lives. For Macbeth, the moment the witches came was after the most massive successes he had ever experienced of winning two battles and enjoying immense popularity. Just look at Elvis, Marilyn, Janice, F. Scott, Kurt, Belushi, Philip Seymour. Some people need mentor coaches not to become successful, but to help them regulate their states of mind, to manage emotions, and to sustain success. Complacency and overconfidence become equal challenges. Navigating extreme success creates unique challenges. Exceptional success can transcend all usual and expectable categories and any prior experiences, such as the athlete who plays really well or defies the limits of physical aging. It also occurs when accomplishments and the resultant fame or wealth or power transcend any kind of anticipation, so someone can't have a model to engage it with or to process it. Here's the simplest statement of all of the above by Keith Richards. Fame has killed more very talented guys than drugs. So let's look at success anti-climax. After Bruce Jenner's last decathlon in Montreal, after 4 decades of competing, he asked, "What am I going to do now?" After a long practiced and anticipated success, people often have to deal with success anticlimax. So here's a portion of what's going on in the brain about that. The sprint system, mediated by dopamine, can create and sustain excitement of expectation, even anticipating a consequence. And we know from various performers, this can last for years or even decades. Then a shift to the neurochemical marathon system that's designed to sustain and balance endeavors, the long run, literally, however, can read as lack of excitement, as if something's missing, even to feeling slightly depressed. Robert Louis Stevenson captured this, I think, when he said very simply, "To travel hopefully is a better thing than to arrive." at least to sustain dopamine, it is. The athletes and executives I've worked with and others I've interviewed have learned to contend with the anticlimax of shifting from stimulating anticipation to sustaining maintenance and to dose anticipation in a very effective way. And I'm talking about this because I think with your work with clients, you will help them come to achieve a success that they may not have ever achieved before and may not know exactly how to deal with it, certainly don't have models internally to deal with it. Now, here's a simple example. I vividly recall my favorite athletic coach first introducing to me his version of this aspect of sports psychology. As a freshman, I thought I was really fortunate to make the traveling squad of 12 players in basketball, even though I felt immensely intimidated by the upperclassmen surrounding me. Just after we won our first tournament and gathered as a team, Coach stood in front of all of us and looked at each of us in turn. We were all feeling really good at the big win, eager to get home and celebrate with a parade downtown. He said, "So we won this tournament. This is not the biggest or the most prestigious tournament that we'll play. In fact, it's kind of a podunk tournament." He paused. "How many of you can really say you're proud to win this tournament?" Now, under any other circumstances, I would have raised my hand quickly, as I suspected my teammates would, but nobody dared venture a single finger in the air. So he concluded, "Feel good for now, but let's get home and really start working on being an excellent team." Coach knew how to handle success anticlimax, to ladder success, to look at what's next, a growth mindset. His life-changing coaching and mentoring of me for 4 years resulted in many wins, state championships, all-state. In reality, it was him who was my original mentor outside my dad. And it was because of that, my two careers of helping others was patterned after that, first in psychiatry, psychoanalysis, now in mentor coaching. For any physical or intellectual achievement, the emotional role and creative closure have to be addressed after a successful completion. I've known a number of authors, for example, who describe a letdown after the completion of their book. One even described it as a postpartum depression, and that was a guy. The most successful achievers evolve their capacities to recover faster from success anticlimax and ladder the next successes. So let's look at this from a different perspective. Does proven evidence change beliefs? Facts and beliefs are anatomical realities in our brains. You don't create a change by suddenly introducing a new idea and expect it to override the one that's already there. And many of you have heard me say, if information were enough, we'd all exercise every day, eat mostly vegetables, be thin, have a lot of money saved up for the future, and a lot of librarians would be billionaires. Facts and logic are not powerful tools to alter opinions. Data is not a way to change anyone's mind. It's simply not how we decide. Established beliefs are extremely resistant to change, even when scientific evidence disproves those beliefs. People regard information as valid evidence when it reinforces their existing views. This is how arguments more staunchly solidify an original position. It's called the boomerang effect, because someone will compare what they believe to what they hear. If it fits, they're going to find ways to confirm it, confirmation bias. If they disagree, they'll find ways to disconfirm it or give it inattention. So they end up more entrenched in their original position, whichever way they hear an argument or information. Presenting someone with information that contradicts an opinion just causes them to create new counter-arguments to further strengthen their view. This is part of the boomerang effect. So people grow more confident in their initial convictions and use information to further polarize opinions like abortion, gun control, climate change, to name a few. We quickly accept evidence that confirms our existing notions, and we assess counter evidence with a critical, even disbelieving eye. Then we may cherry pick information to fortify our beliefs without even being consciously aware of it. In fact, some recent studies have shown that the more intelligent people are, the greater their ability to creatively rationalize and reinterpret information to fit their opinions. They use their intelligence not to examine data or draw more accurate conclusions, but to find fault in creative ways to what they already disbelieve. The mind's desire for continuity and certainty, coupled with activating the brain's error detection mechanism with new and unexpected information, both contribute to the continuity of belief and action. So let's look at how that may manifest, a couple of examples of how that may manifest in business. A success trap in business is an almost ubiquitous phenomenon in which a company needs to shift the way it operates in order to survive. Examples: the canal boat companies of the 1700s didn't become the railroad companies of the 1800s. They stuck to their box. Good to gone. Motorola stuck to their story and slid from a premier electronics firm to a troubled industry. Meanwhile, Nokia asked and listened to children and young people just developing their stories and used their feedback to become world class. Good to great. Another example, Kodak, stuck to analog photography, did not evolve to digital. More recently, Andy Grove at Intel described the success trap as being a time in an organization's life when the leaders have to think differently and have to move away from the organizational rigidity of developing and refining what's already successfully in place to think creatively and what can be in order to evolve. Grove said, "Miss the moment and you start to decline." He noted that the difficulty at Intel to move from memory chips to embrace the next technology of microprocessing in order to sustain the viability of the entire company was a premier example. So successful performance for an individual or company can sustain focus on what created the success rather than looking to evolving to the next success. The new success becomes the old success without a new model to step into. So attention to execution of the current success can cause you to miss the innovation needed to take next steps forward. An example, brain scans of 63 seasoned business decision makers showed two things. Moving to a new territory of exploratory strategies disengages from the pleasing routine of certainty. To leave the default mode to attend to new possibilities is uncomfortable and takes more energy. Yet at the same time, creative innovation stimulates brain circuitry of anticipation and reward. Replay that and think of your client. Moving into new territory moves from certainty, from repetition, from the default mode, to doing something new that's uncomfortable. So it takes more energy. I think it's helpful at times if we resonate with that experience of our clients to let them know that we know and we get how it's challenging or uncomfortable to do something that's not known or proven or that they're familiar with. Yet we also know that as they sustain that, it will stimulate brain circuitry of anticipation and reward. And that's led by the pleasure neurochemical dopamine. So I want to just give you some examples, and this is nowhere near a complete list, but some performance-related biases and their remedies. There will be more in your outline than we talk about, but I just want to highlight some things that some specific biases can be created or exaggerated, especially by success, and can then have an impact on performance. Awareness of the tendency of these biases to psychologically influence decision and even to dilute optimum performance is important to recognize. One and probably the most common is self-deception. These deceptions have been distilled from a number of studies. One is self-inflation, especially at times of significant success. Examples. 94% of people place themselves in the top half of their profession. 70% of both women and men feel they're better looking than average. 19% of people believe they're in the top 1% of income. 70% of drivers believe they're better than average. And 75% of people consider themselves to be healthier than average. Remember, average is 50. Another derogation of others. This is kind of the shadow story of self-inflation. That can occur when an image has been tarnished or a need to align with an in-group and degrade the outgoing, or, like in Stockholm syndrome, to align with the powerful, identification with the aggressor. Another, moral superiority. Naturally, the referees are right when they call a foul on the visiting team. The worst mistake they can make is to call a foul, at least on my home team, the Houston Rockets. But if I moved to Dallas, I would instantly become, don't call a foul on my favorite Maverick. Another is the illusion of control. When we feel a lack of control, it enhances our tendency to see meaningful patterns in otherwise random data. It gives us a false sense of effectiveness. And that's how, let me give you a simple example of that. Both you and your client want you to make a suggestion or give advice during a coaching session. Not that it's going to be right, not that it's going to be followed, but because it forecloses exploration and the cognitive strain of keeping it open and examining it. So the client is more comfortable, you're more comfortable, and they're not going to follow your advice most likely, but at least for right now, it's a done deal. And you can think about, you know, what you're going to do after dinner. Another is invincibility bias. Here are some common examples. Adolescents may tend to estimate danger poorly and to exaggerate anticipated performance, even to do risky behavior. Skiers can ignore warning signs and enter restricted areas to ski dangerous terrain, sometimes to their peril. Or someone sees a roulette wheel stop on red 6 times in a row, what's your next bet going to be? If you believe that the chances are different than 50-50, that it'll stop on black the next spin, they got you. 100% of those who believe the roulette wheel has memory will abandon the 50-50 red-black probability, will be wrong. They'll be right sometimes, but that's not going to work. Optimism bias. This is a tendency to underestimate the possibility of bad events in our lives and to overestimate the possibility of good events. We underestimate the likelihood of a car accident, of having cancer, and overestimate our life expectancy and even future income. Newlyweds estimate the likelihood of divorce at 0 to 10%, while statistically, almost 50% will end in divorce. Here's another, hindsight bias. Knowing how things turned out can influence the way we both remember and even reframe past events to make an outcome seem inevitable. Subjectivity bias. We have an ability to spot thinking and systematic errors in others, but we may struggle to look objectively and assess our own. We can see biases in our friends way more easily than in ourselves, simply because we're observers of them, and we can't as easily bring into objective focus our own process of thinking and behaving. And remember, as we've discussed briefly before, a major aspect of what you do in mentor coaching is to help your client become more empathically aware of themselves, to develop self-reflection and self-awareness to be able to regulate their states of mind. That's just another way of saying all that we've been talking about in these four seminars and how essential that is. So we put great value in the present so much that it may take a massive future reward to forego an impulse or pleasure in the present to invest in the future. The future is both a theory and an abstraction, so it competes poorly with the immediate reward of the pleasure chemical of dopamine. That's why it's hard to save for the future. That's why it's not hard to spend on a credit card. And when you use a credit card, you spend up to 30% more than if you actually use money or write a check, because it's a future abstraction. And there's the immediacy of the dopamine. Transparency bias. When we perceive fairness, the brain releases the pleasure chemical of dopamine. If we perceive unfairness, this triggers the reptilian brain that mediates the perception of threat and survival with a very different neurochemical system. Fairness, a keystone in both collaboration and leadership, can be overridden by the sense of unfairness that can interfere, actually, with creativity and motivation and teamwork. So a major factor in the perception of fairness is transparency, the effort we perceive that goes into a task or an item. We often use the amount of effort we actually see as a shortcut for the perception of value. When something takes little time or looks easy, or when the work itself is not visible, not transparent to the recipient, significant reactions occur. For example, an attorney charges $500 for an hour for a work that's not transparent. A plumber charging $200 for a visit when the actual repair work only takes 4 to 5 minutes. Here's a simple example. If two people who live together are put in separate rooms and each ask the amount of housework the other does, the combined figure will be over 100%. This is a transparency asymmetry. Each is aware primarily of their own work, but unaware of the extent and time of work of the other, the partner. We value what we perceive more accurately when it's transparent. Here's a projection bias. People who believe that others often hold the same beliefs and values that they do, and see the future in that way too. Fan psychology, for example, employs some innate projection bias. Being a fan of a particular team or group, by definition, distorts thinking and creates bias. We identify with a player or performer or an organization, and our thinking influences our behaviors. This automatically frames how we view a call by a referee, for example, as I mentioned, and we immediately lapse into all or nothing, good or bad thinking. Well, that's a self-statement. Other examples include seeing how ethnocentric our own views in the United States are when traveling to different parts of the world. That's been a repeated observation, and I'm still surprised in a way when I travel to other countries and see how much more inclusive and expansive and aware they are of things in the world, and how very centered we are in the United States in our own way in our own ways of seeing things, our own values and beliefs. Now, let's look. There are a number of other kind of biases, conscious and unconscious. Let's look at some bias remedies that may be helpful as coaches. Now, a bias means that we not only ignore certain data, but we specifically ignore disconfirming data. Facts contrary to beliefs and self-images are rapidly dismissed or simply not engaged. Inattention blindness. A cue for a bias can simply be an anchor for booting up a particular mindset. It can be race, gender, weight, any number of other things that we automatically and largely have unconscious attribution for. Then, natural gravitation occurs to others who share the same mindset to engage in groupthink to further the notions and find evidence to affirm them. Groupthink can simply be shared blind spots. We ignore contrary evidence and share a self-deception. We work diligently to preserve our opinions, even though we may not consciously know exactly what they are. The challenge then, and this is from the roadmap system, back to our first seminar, the first three components of the roadmap system to look at and understand the algorithms we operate on, to recognize, own, and assess certain aspects of our own stories. The first three steps of the roadmap system. The primary reason it's a challenge. These first three steps are a challenge. New information may cause unpleasant feelings. New information may demand a change in beliefs. We tend to seek information that confirm our beliefs rather than disprove them. And new information may require us to take undesired actions. Now, all of these can be summarized in the simple description of what we do as mentor coaches. We help someone break their script. The automatic operating system, that 90 to 95% that's unconscious, when it becomes conscious, is no longer unconscious, but we break the script because we examine assumptions, biases, experiences and beliefs that don't work, and we collaboratively engage them to look at revision. So to leave the security of our known stories and the certainty and predictability of how they're going to turn out feels like a lack of control. We're motivated to avoid new information, especially if we expect bad news. Seeking a consultation with a doctor about certain symptoms confronts the denial and the pain also of undergoing testing. And it may be more difficult when the information is hard to understand or interpret. So we first have to realize what we don't know. This is difficult, but how do you come to know what you don't know? Candid, open feedback from trusted others becomes one way. In executive coaching, at times, I've used a 360-degree assessment instrument to help someone self-assess, then get assessments on the same questions from a group of people who know that person quite well and can anonymously give feedback. This significantly challenges the comfort zone, but it can provide objective and valuable information. So let's look at the hubris syndrome. You will work with clients who have this going on, so I think it's helpful to look at it and have a way to think about it. While confidence is a state of mind that generates remarkable productivity, overconfidence can become a slayer of success. Our minds constantly learn from challenges, internally and externally. And the creative empathic process, though, can be derailed by a state change such as power or wealth or fame or any of the accompaniments of success. It's been shown that the more that we know and the better we become, the more likely we are to overestimate our own ability as well as underestimate the events beyond our control. In one study, CEOs become more confident as they gain merger and acquisition experience, resulting in their overvaluation of subsequent deals. In research from the University of Vienna, investors who obtained significant experience with their market became overconfident in risky asset trades. So overconfidence can be the brain's potentiation of stimulation, and it can be enhanced with sustained success and power. Blind certainty can replace active self-reflection. Overconfidence can increase with familiarity, repetition, information, and especially with significant success. One of the best predictors of overconfidence is power, which enhances with time and experience and can result in the cessation of questioning alternate possibilities. Let's consider just briefly talent and the role of talent. A growth mindset recognizes that talent can be enhanced through dedication and deliberate practice. A fixed mindset sees talents as either present or not present, not to be developed. Edwin Moses, winner of 107 consecutive races and 4 world records, said, "I ran against a lot of individuals who were probably more physically talented than me." We know from a number of perspectives that talent is not genetic, but it's a developmental process. It can be enhanced when it's recognized, focused on, and nurtured by parents, teachers, coaches, mentors. Discipline and deliberate practice evolve both intellectual and physical talent. The social setting and enhancing framework can contribute to both motivation and the development and maturation of talent. So, for example, to recognize an advanced sports talent in the socially prominent areas is easy. Baseball, basketball in the United States, soccer in England, ice hockey in Canada. Sports make it easy because they're so visible, they're identifiable, they're measurable. Talent in other areas may not be as easily recognized, perhaps even be invisible, not transparent. Talent in art, verbal ability. Physical and mental skills become challenges, possibly, to identify and facilitate. So while there are innate physical and mental capacities, just as individual personality and learning style, the developmental process must be systematically nurtured by discipline and practice. An optimum model evolved from various studies about the development of expertise and talent includes 3 aspects. Early diversification, sampling of a number of activities, and exposure for both informed choices and long-term involvement. Deliberate play, for example, of experiencing sport through fun and playful games becomes a solid foundation for intrinsic motivation. Deliberate play establishes a range of cognitive and motor experiences to develop both expertise and self-management, as well as a foundation for generalizable skill. Only later, experts suggest, maybe not as much as until age 13, should specialization occur, and only by late adolescence have children developed the physical, social, cognitive, emotional, and motor skills needed to specialize in one sport or one endeavor. So a composite of studies of elite performers across a number of fields has found these common traits that characterize their development and expertise. And these are in your outline: regulating state of mind, managing anxiety and pressure, confidence, mental toughness and resilience, the ability to focus, hard work ethic, the practice of setting and achieving goals, being able to work with a mentor and coach, and optimism. So, is there a disadvantage of talent? The answer is possibly. The talent myth assumes a fixed mindset. Why spend more time and energy trying to improve if success only comes to people with the right talent or the right genes? That skill and intelligence can be improved is a growth mindset, on the other hand. So talent can be a potential disadvantage if someone with a natural talent, whether that's intellectual or sports or any kind of talent, from the very beginning may not subject themselves to the same hard work, rigors, and dedication as someone without those natural talents. So they may not develop the resilience that needed and may not develop related skills to supplement their achievement, such as knowing their opponent, engagement strategies, other adaptations for whatever kind of endeavor they're engaging. If you rely too much on a natural athletic or intellectual capacity, then that kind of adversity and the skills of resilience don't develop. A shadow story of talent is that it can mask poor teaching or coaching for a significant period of time or even until it's time to play a bigger game in some challenging way, intellectually or physically. Now, let's talk just a couple of things I want to cover before we wrap up. One is sustainable success. And this will be something to keep in mind, I think, as coaches, as you're working with clients who do achieve a significant success. The question then becomes not getting lost in that success or engaging and inhabiting the story of success, but to continue to look at the growth mindset of sustaining and further enhancing that success. After their first unprecedentedly successful whirlwind tour of the United States, the first thing the Beatles did when they got back to England was to go to the studio and make their next album. And they made a new album regularly, every 6 months. They didn't bask in their victory or let it derail their plans. They consolidated the success to integrate it with ongoing focus and plans. They pressed their advantage but did not let success derail their plans or hijack their focus. Here's a case study. I know a couple of you have wanted to talk a little bit more about applications here. A client I'll call Evelyn consulted me because she was having burnout in her career. She had enjoyed remarkable and rapid success as an actress, moving quickly through local theater productions, national commercials, and a role in a prominent nationally syndicated series. Her energy brightened the room. It induced optimism in others. It was a part of her magic. People were impressed with her imaginative and creative presence. Being highly intuitive and sensitive allowed her attunement and connection to others, as well as to inhabit fully the character she played. With this sensitivity came the resonance with stressful emotions from those around her. She was an intuitive empath. It resulted in feeling emotionally drained, especially by people who would want a selfie, an autograph, just to say hello. She described her sensitivity to family and friends, and especially by even fans who would approach her at restaurants and public places. She wanted to please them. She wanted to be the nice person she was and enjoy the popularity, but she was depleted after these experiences. She questioned whether the burnout meant she was not suited for what she was doing, even though she really enjoyed the recognition and the stardom a great deal and seemed passionate about developing her craft. We explored her state of mind during and after these experiences. She described how she had to go home because she was depleted. She would feel drained for hours. Even a nap would not restore her energy. Her high degree of creativity and imagination was a natural for her expert work, but she didn't have the necessary buffers and boundaries to regulate her state of mind to protect her energy and to protect herself that resulted then in significant depletion. So she needed to develop an internal point of reference. We began with needs and ideals to align with strategies and goals so that all of her could be going in the same direction, whether personal or professional time. So her intuitive, empathic style, at times selfless, was eroding the joy from her accomplishment. So we focused on her desire to resonate with and nurture others and how it needed to be developed within herself first, not to abandon herself, to remain grounded in her own experience. She then developed a way to carve out her private space. Times devoted to her needs have specific boundaries in her interfaces with others. These pragmatic strategies allowed her to preserve her energy and to deploy it then by conscious choice rather than in a reactive mode. For example, she developed an awareness of how the character that she inhabited for a screen role was itself a state of mind and how to effectively enter and exit that state of mind each day so that she could preserve her own private space and not intermingle the two. She learned to dose time and titrate her exposure to others to reduce the excess stimulation of crowds, especially the needy or negative people, was reframed as a necessary self-care, not guilt at saying no to fans. She built in quiet time to emotionally decompress and recharge. She learned the value of meditation, of calming mini breaks through the day, to do a 2-minute mindfulness meditation as a response to signals that might otherwise have triggered a default mode of reactivity. So by protecting herself in this way and being attuned to the necessary boundaries between herself and others, she maintained her valued sensitivity and empathic resonance with herself first, as well as with others, without absorbing the impact of the feeling of others. And being a very visual person, her mantra included a visual focus rather than a word phrase. Remember, we talked about the mantra the first seminar. She envisioned being enveloped in a cone of warm light around her entire body that offered energy as well as protection. It blocked any negative responses, any negativity, as well as restored her own energy and internal point of reference. She used that visualization before she would do, for example, appearances on talk shows or various things as a way to get grounded and centered. These necessary steps to stay centered in an otherwise very demanding world of fame were invaluable for her to sustain her energy and to continue to contribute in ways that she valued. This capacity for full emotional engagement and empathic attunement to oneself first. Remember, I mentioned to you guys, develop your own story fully, completely first. Then you'll be in the best position to help your clients develop their stories, whatever that story is. Wellness, money, life story, whatever it is. So this capacity for full emotional engagement and empathic attunement generated significant success and awards for her acting roles. After much research, she actually could become the character she played. She had an amazing empathic ability to resonate with that character and to develop the character from the point of reference of the persona of that character. But by more effectively grounding and centering herself and cultivating mindfulness, she developed a greater resilience to the influence and emotion of others. She recognized how to automatically put the needs of others in perspective with her own. Her career soared even higher. Now, I mention this in a bit more detail because this is exactly what you may think of doing with your client. You want to fully engage with that client, to understand their experience, to help them develop their story, not be sidetracked or derailed in any way by your own story or by one wondering if you're saying the right thing, but a total immersion to develop the story of your client and remaining objectively, subjectively, and objectively aware of your own story, and to help the client do the same thing for their story. So I want to, there are a number of distinctions between experts and amateurs. And I just want to highlight, I'm not going to go over them all because they're in your outline. I think this quote is in the outline. This is important, and I've heard Bum Phillips say this to the rookie running back Earl Campbell when he was just about to make his legendary and future All-Pro debut into the NFL. He said, "When you get to the end zone, act like you've been there before. In other words, don't go nuts." So an expert and an amateur are simply states of mind. They're each states of mind. The expert is an ideal, a contrast to the amateur. Evolution from amateur to expert is a significant life-changing passion and passage when it occurs. Here are some distinctions that can apply to that process of transformation. And I'm just going to highlight a few here that I want to really draw attention to and let you look at the rest and reflect on them. Experts continue concentrated, deliberate practice on focused areas to develop with informed feedback. Amateurs get to a level of good enough and stay there. Experts seek practice and goals that exceed current levels of performance. Amateurs seek to sustain a comfort level without challenging it. An example can be if you're really good at something, it's a lot easier and more fun to practice at what you're good at rather than practice at what you really need practice at. If you're terrific at hitting forehands, it's tough to practice backhands because you're not as good. It feels not as pleasing and comfortable. But if you practice forehands all the time, your game will suffer. Experts understand there is no predetermined limit of ability. Amateurs believe there's a fixed reserve of potential. The expert loves and pursues the game, whatever the game is, with total dedication and passion. The amateur may see it as a sideline, as part-time, like a weekend warrior. The expert keeps going no matter what. Stamina and resilience. The amateur can be dissuaded by setback and adversity. And here you'll be thinking of this or coaching toward this with many clients. The expert does what is important first. Amateurs do what's urgent first. You know, for example, sometimes a football team can do more in the final 2 minutes of a half than in the previous 28 minutes. With imminent clock and finite time remaining, they can focus energy and attention and concentration. The expert operates for the entire game in this zone rather than waiting for the two-minute warning. Now, as a sidebar here, since you asked, one of the most important things anyone has ever said to me is we always find time for what's really important. Think about that. The expert knows that fairness is a childhood wish, that in adulthood, there is no ultimate arbiter of fairness. There's always adversity, unlevel fields, bad hops, rotten calls, injustice, bias, unfairness. The amateur seeks fairness and is set back at what doesn't seem fair. The expert does whatever it takes, even what could never have been imagined. The amateur, on the other hand, seems to need predictability, consistency, and assuredness of results. The expert dedicates to mastery. the amateur dedicates to proving himself or herself, needing to consistently demonstrate superiority and dominance. I'll just do a couple more because I want to allow more time for discussion. The expert does not take things or people personally, recognizes that others always make self-statements, and does not succumb to criticism, envy, or idealization of others. The amateur is subject to the perception of others, to rejection, reads the responses of others as if they were looking into an accurate mirror of themselves. And you will work with people who developmentally have experienced not having accurate mirrors for all of who they are to develop their own ideals. They've looked into the mirror of parents to define who they are and not known it at the time, but they're looking in a funhouse mirror or a mirror that part of it has been blackened. So these kind of developmental issues will emerge as you're working with someone in coaching, and you will become the accurate mirror for your client to give them feedback. So as a total sidebar here, this is why I think it's so very important that we work in a collaborative alliance with clients so that the client unequivocally knows that we have their best interest at heart, that we are 100% dedicated to their success, and that we'll do that no matter what. So this is the collaborative alliance that you have with someone, and when the client knows that, you can get away with saying what you need to say. And some of the things we need to say are tough to hear. They're looking together at something the client does not want to look at, does not want to examine. And breaking the script is, by definition, uncomfortable because you're challenging and derailing the default mode. Just a couple more. The expert shows up every day no matter what, is committed for the long haul, and understands delayed gratification. The amateur shows up as long as something else doesn't get in the way. The amateur looks for shortcuts, quick results, and immediate gratification. Now, I know I'm doing a caricature of both the expert and the amateur, but I'm going to stick with it because I think it's useful to characterize for discussion. The expert believes that we write, live, and create in order to know. The amateur believes that we must know in order to write, live, and create. Expert add value to their art, science, expert body of knowledge, and to others. Amateurs add value to themselves. The expert believes that certainty develops with proceeding and mastery. The amateur must have certainty in order to proceed. Whenever you hear from your client limiting assumptions, well, I need to have experience, or I need to be confident in order to proceed. I need to be comfortable in order to proceed. None of those are places we began from or with. We don't begin with comfort. We don't begin with confidence. The expert punches through the bag, runs through the finish line. The amateur hits the front of the bag and relaxes the finish line. The expert knows that courage is to proceed despite fear. The amateur believes that courage is the absence of fear. Now, in summary, the application of these principles that we've been talking about, stress mastery, peak performance, can apply to all areas, business, education, arts, health, human relationships, sports. As we become more self-reflective and better learners, we more effectively write our own stories, whether they're life, career, wellness, relationship, money, any other. All are contributions to ourselves. So thank you so much for your time and interest, as well as all the feedback and kind words. I'll be eager to hear now and as you think about it later, or those of you who listen to recordings, interested to hear feedback. And maybe even if you use and apply any of these ideas, if they're helpful to you in your coaching practice to use with clients, I'd love to hear that as well. So I'm going to put us on discussion mode, so if you'll manage the background noise and hang around if you have time and have anything to add or ask or clarify or anything that you'd like to discuss. Okay, we're in discussion mode now. So what would you, is there anything you'd like to discuss a bit more and or to add or ask in any way to what we've been talking about? Any clarification first of anything that didn't quite make sense or that you have questions about as we look back on it? Here's one more principle that's a quote. I think I can get this pretty close. I'm going to stick with it no matter what. One of my favorite writers, John Updike, wrote about performance and optimizing performance. One of his characters was Sandy, the caddy, and the golfer he named Farrell. So here's sort of how he said it. Sandy consistently handed Farrell one club too short to make the green. His caddy was handing the club to the stronger golfer latent in Farrell, and it was Farrell's job to let this superior performer out, to release him from his stiff, soft, more than middle-aged body. That's what we do with clients. We believe in them and help them get to where they didn't quite know or believe or have experienced before. Every client you work with will get to a place that they haven't quite experienced yet or have to deal with a success for which they have no model. So one of the things we're doing is to help them develop a way to have a model, to how to look at how to systematically consider that and look at developing a model that can be applicable, that's consistent with their needs, their ideals, and the situation. So this is a collaborative strategy that you develop with your clients. So I'm interested to hear if there are clarifications or questions or anything else you'd like to talk about, or any vignette or situation that might be helpful for us to talk about. Well, if not now, I welcome any emails or questions that you have. Fire off an email to me if I can be of help to you in any way. It's been a privilege to work with you. I really appreciate your ongoing feedback. And let me know if I can be of help. And if you have any follow-up thoughts or comments, questions, benefits, anything at all about this series. So thanks very, very much, and I'll be eager to hear from you. See you guys. Bye now.